Hello and welcome to the Gadget Show podcast, the place where tech nostalgia meets the cutting edge. I'm Jason Bradbury.
And you're really awake. And I'm Susie Perry. And before we dive in, a quick shout out, if we will, to our sponsors, NordVPN. They're keeping us and you safe online with their top tier encryption. So stay tuned until later in the episode for an exclusive deal where you might get a cheeky little discount just for listening.
Yep, that's well worth sticking around for. But first, let's get stuck in. Coming up in this episode, we've got a deep dive into some weird retro gadgets, which I know Susie and I are huge fans of, and a first look at the revival of no less than the Pebble smartwatch. Let's do this.
First of all, though, a few comments from you, lovely lot. Thank you so much. Annie Spitt on YouTube says, Jace, can you recommend a handheld console for my husband who's new to gaming? I bought him Rogue Ally and it's a bit too complicated for him. So can you recommend something that he can basically just switch on and play a game?
Okay, that's interesting. I've never really thought about the Rogue Ally being a complicated experience. But you know what? I actually identify with what you're talking about. I can see that for someone that doesn't want to fiddle around with the menus and stuff.
And he's new also to gaming, whereas obviously, yeah, you came out the womb doing it.
Yeah, exactly. No, I do get it. I do get that. So I'm going to give you a two-tier answer. I'm going to say, if you want to step down in complexity, but still with the opportunity to play AAA titles, then it's the good old Steam Deck. The latest version, the OLED Steam Deck, would be the one that I would recommend. Okay. Not uncomplicated, but it all runs around the Steam library and the Steam shop. You can buy games, they're all in one place, and it does represent a pretty polished gaming experience, but still offering the opportunity to get outside kind of trivial gaming and play some good AAA decent titles. All right, but if that is still too complex and it's just an occasional game, a fun, turn it on, just get into something trivial and fun and colourful, it's got to be the Switch, Suze, don't you think?
Mm. Although, I think that's what she's sort of aiming at, isn't she? That kind of experience.
I think you're right. But I would say, Annie, that just be cautious, because as we have reported on this current series, of course, there's a new Switch just around the corner. They're going to be showcasing it for the first time in, you know, a matter of about 4 weeks' time. So just maybe hold off on that. I think that's the best answer I can come up with.
I'm going to pick up with the next one as well, Jace. Toxic Wolf UK says, hey, Jason, Suze, being a retro gamer, have you ever tried AntStream Arcade?
Love them. Absolutely love AntStream. So for those listening and watching that aren't familiar with it, it's a subscription-based retro gaming service that enables you to play classic, actual classic games that existed, so not you know, sort of made-up titles, of classic arcade and console-style titles via a cloud-based service that means you can play them on just about any device, including, I think, phones and iPads and tablets, although, you know, fact-check me, listeners and viewers, by all means. You can use a Bluetooth controller if you want. You can just, you know, you can, it's very flexible, it's very inexpensive, there's a whole ton of games, and they're a really lovely bunch. They're really nice people. In fact, some of my friends work for AntStream, so, you know, I don't know, I don't feel like I'm being biased. I think it's a really good service, but just, you know, just to let you know. Geordie Mac says, this is in response to his VR Dead, I love my Meta headset, but Horizon, which is a social space that Meta created for all of their users to meet and play games and chat, is full of kids. So I spend most of the time playing games or in rooms with my mates. This is an issue that many people come across, many adult players. Not that they've got anything against kids, but they're not, you know, it's not fun to play, I don't know, paintball in, say, Rec Room, which is similar to Horizon, and just get kids being silly and screaming at you or getting offended and stuff. It's kind of annoying. Even my favorite game, sort of hangout social space in VR, which is VR chat, also has kids, and it gets a bit awkward and a bit strange at times, you know, because kids, they're not developed enough to have proper conversations. And it just, I think there needs to be some form of age filter on these things. And also, as a parent, it concerns me as well that you know what I mean, that maybe these platforms aren't extending enough of a care framework to make sure that children aren't being exposed to conversation and or virtual experiences that are not age appropriate. So I'm with you, Geordie Mac. It's a pain in the backside. I think just make a point, you know. I think that's what, you know, X or email is for. Make a point, make a loud point. In fact, I tell you what, I'll put something on X about it. I think that's a really good point that you've made. Look out for my Twitter account, Jason Bradbury, and get behind the conversation. Let's see if we can get a buzz going around it.
Okay, good idea. Also in response to Is VR Dead, our last podcast, Arla Soft says, the weird thing about VR is I think it's amazing technology. I think we all agree with that. I've made games for VR and I do enjoy games like Red Matter or Golf Plus, yet most of the time I can't be bothered to dig out and boot up the headset, and eye strain is definitely a thing, especially if you go for a while without playing it. I have got 20/20 vision, but in VR it feels like my eyes are out on stalk sometimes. This is what we said, wasn't it, in the conversation. Arla's sort of agreeing with that. You know, it's fantastic and you admire it, but do you actually pick it up and use it a lot, or is it an occasional thing? So thank you for your message there. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for your comments. Keep them coming. We love to read them. And if you want a direct line to the Gadget Show crew, then make sure you subscribe to our Patreon page. Subscribing really does help our podcast.
Yeah, and if you'd prefer to listen or watch the podcast ad-free, being a Patreon sub is the only way to do that. And not only that, you'll also get exclusive episodes and extra behind-the-scenes content.
And the chance to join us live and play with some amazing tech when we record in our shiny Birmingham studio. So that's very cool.
So what are you waiting for? Head over to our Patreon page right now.
Yeah, the link is in the description, so we'll see you there. Right, let's move on to this week's headline discussion then. It's called The Weirdest Retro Gadgets. Got to have your teeth in for that one.
Yes, some nostalgia, Suze. It's a wonderful thing. But let's be honest, not every gadget from the past was a hit. Some were way ahead of their time. Some were just bizarre. And some make you wonder what the hell the designers were thinking.
Yeah, and I feel like I tested ever such a lot of them on the Gadget Show. We're diving into the weird, the wonderful, and the downright wacky world of retro tech. From gadgets that tried to be the future to inventions that probably should have stayed on the drawing board, this is our rundown of the weirdest retro gadgets ever.
I love it. So prepare for a trip down memory lane with a few questionable design choices along the way.
Right, I'll kick off with something called Satellaview. So it came out in 1995. So imagine if your gaming console could download exclusive games from space. That's exactly what Nintendo's Satellaview did, as long as you lived in Japan and had access to a satellite dish. So I think you can probably see where this is going a bit, Jace. It was released in 1995. The platform was Super Nintendo. The technology used was Zengiga Satellite Network to broadcast exclusive games and content, but there were broadcast times, so it was only at specific hours of the day. So if you missed it, the content was no longer there. So it was like an appointment to view, really.
I love that.
Yeah, I know, I like it now as well, but it didn't work. But so the types of games that were available were things like Zelda BS, Radical Dreamers, F-Zero Grand Prix was in there, and that, you know, there was a whole lot more. And it lasted about 5 years. It got discontinued.
Really? Yeah, I'm amazed it lasted that. Look, I think the phrase that we're scratching at here is scarcity. Scarcity is a thing that we don't really have. I mean, my wife and I often talk about this with our kids. You know, the notion that, that they can play any tune that's ever created when we go to the gym, whereas we would have, you know, 10 tunes on one side of a cassette.
Yeah.
And then 10 on the other. Yeah, when we went to the gym or went to the park, roller skating or whatever in the 80s and 90s. That notion, well, it doesn't exist anymore by necessity, but sometimes it does exist by design, doesn't it? Have you noticed some of the kind of cool startups will add fake scarcity to the release of a product? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that you mentioned that, because we've almost gone full circle, haven't we? Because I think I've mentioned on the podcast before that the streamers now, like Netflix and Apple and so on, they, instead of having that whole dump of being able to watch and binge watch everything, they've got this release every week now, and they're in line with the States. Appointment to view television again. So they're kind of going back to what terrestrial TV, you know, is, and why terrestrial TV lost out in the first place, or one of the reasons, you know, was because you could binge on streamers, but you can't on terrestrial. But they're going back to that appointment to view
because
now,
it brings meaning to the experience. Yeah. If you're having to wait for a satellite, I'm guessing because they didn't have enough satellites, so you had to wait till it was overhead, is I'm guessing the reason why there was a waiting period. In the same way, I was just Googling then, the console, which I think we've mentioned in the last series, actually, the portable console, the Playdate, which is the one with that wind-up thing on the side, Susie, do you remember? And that console, they release games, but they release them sporadically. So you buy the console and then you wait for one of the games to be released and then you download it and you wait another few weeks for another one to be released. And I think it's a really interesting idea that sometimes there is value in not having, you know, unlimited potential content.
Yeah, creating that appetite really for something new. It's I like it. But I think, you know, I'm cool. Old-fashioned like that, but I think it's a healthy situation to create.
I'm going to be honest with you, you have found one of the very few pieces of retro gaming hardware that I've never experienced. I know of it. In fact, I do a quiz with some friends on a Sunday, and it was a question in our quiz recently about this satellite gaming service. But I've never utilised it, never seen it. I'd be really interested to see what some of the gameplay is like.
So in summary, it didn't work because it was a watch it live or lose it scenario, which we like now.
We love now, don't we?
It would be interesting to bring it back now. It could be quite kind of folksy if we brought it back now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, play it live while the satellite goes over.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I've got another contender for potentially worst retro gadget of 1997, this one. It's the Sony Glastron, which was kind of, I mean, I'd call it a VR headset.
Yeah.
Before VR was cool, but not really. It's more of a kind of viewing device from what I can recall. So again, you know, looks beautiful. Yeah, I'm guessing those watching the podcast will have seen an image on screen right now, but I'll describe it to you like a sort of grey headband that clips over the top of your head, and then with a drop down screen, remarkably small considering that it was a video display in 1997, like a kind of pair of ski glasses or goggles over your eyes, in which were two displays. The idea was that you could kind of, you know, sit in the back of the car and watch some content. The display that you get is equivalent to a 52-inch screen viewed from about 6.5 feet. The resolution, nothing to get excited about, certainly by today's standards. 832 by 624 pixels, Susie.
And really, really expensive.
Yeah, yes, around 1,500 quid. Is that what your research tells you about?
Yeah, about, but in 1997, imagine paying, well, even now, really, but, you know, yeah, imagine
that's
paying
like,
that.
Yeah. It's got it with inflation. That's a couple of grand, isn't it? Why was it weird? Well, because as Susie so rightly points out, it was very, very expensive, but it was also heavy and rather uncomfortable. And I don't think, you know, I don't think the viewing experience was particularly good.
No, and I think it also resulted in people having headaches, didn't it? Because it was a bit clunky and
yes,
it's always the problem, isn't it?
I think it hit that sweet spot on the on the forehead that ultimately results in a bit of a headache. Importantly, though, what would have excited me had I actually got to play with it back in the day was that you could plug your console into it, because it had a little box, little breakout box that you kind of, I guess you wore it on your hip, and you could whack the output, the video output from your, I guess, first generation Xbox, maybe, and then have the gaming experience displayed, you know, 832 by 624 pixels, which back then, I think it would have been a pretty appealing idea. So in conclusion, you know, I would say that the Glastron head-mounted display was really ahead of its time because it was so small and the product design was quite futuristic. It was just expensive and headache-inducing. Okay, so this is probably the most tenuous link I'll ever do, Suze, but if you're now in the mood to go searching on the intimate web for retro gadgets, there's one thing you need, and that's security. And that's why Susie and I trust NordVPN, the world's leading virtual private network service, whether you're shopping online or streaming. NordVPN keeps your data safe.
Now, it's no surprise to you that I do quite a lot of online shopping, Jace,
really?
For those last-minute tech gifts, things like that. But cyber criminals, of course, they love to target shoppers. And I don't fancy my card details being stolen. But with NordVPN, I can browse and buy securely knowing that my data is encrypted.
Yeah, I can totally see you panic buying the latest air fryer at midnight tonight, hoping for next day delivery.
Guilty, guilty, guilty as charged, Jace. But beyond shopping, NordVPN also stops those annoying targeted ads. You know when you search for a new pair of headphones and suddenly every website is shoving ads in your face.
How did you know I was searching for some new headphones?
Oh, well, Big Sister is watching you. NordVPN's Threat Protection Pro blocks trackers. So I can shop in peace without feeling like I'm being watched, unlike you, Jace, because I'm always watching you. So whether you're a digital nomad like me or an AI obsessive like Jace, NordVPN has your back. It's fast, secure, and so easy to use.
Absolutely. Right now, NordVPN are offering an exclusive deal for our listeners. Head to nordvpn.com/, and this is the important bit, gadget show, and you'll get 4 extra months free on a 2-year plan. Plus, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee.
Yeah, so don't miss out. Stay secure online and unlock the internet's full potential with NordVPN. Check out the clickable link in the episode description. Right, I've got another weird retro gadget for you, Jace.
Yeah.
Do you remember when Dallas Campbell was on The Gadget Show?
Yeah.
Me and him did a challenge to create the biggest party using party gadgets. And I can't remember if it was me or Dallas, but one of us used this, the Sony Rollie. It was back in 2007. It was like a dancing MP3 player. I know that sounds really weird. But can you imagine if your MP3 player could spin, dance and flash lights to your music?
Yeah, but it was weird because if I remember, it looked a bit like a rugby ball, like a, you know, coloured rugby ball. And it had like rubber bits on it so it could actually grip the floor. And it would just spin around erratically. It didn't have like a face on it, did it? Or ears?
No,
or cute little
no.
eyes?
No.
It was very odd. It was like a hybrid between a sort of Nintendo cutesy character and just a Bluetooth speaker. Really odd.
Yeah, I mean, they thought it was obviously a good idea. They released it in 2007. It had 2 gig flash memory storage. It would have been about 500 songs at the time. Five hours of battery playback, so that's okay. The price at launch, though, it was quite expensive, actually. It was £300 at the time.
Right.
I probably bigged it up at the time, but it danced. And that was it. That was its sort of USP. There wasn't a screen or proper controls, you know, just that kind of vibe, really. That's why I've thrown it in as a contender.
It's great. I mean, I think to make the list, while the gadgets may ultimately commercially have failed, they need to be quirky. They need to have something about them, like you can only play games for a few hours per day or whatever it is, you know, on the satellite service. Or you're a speaker, but it didn't even dance as such. It just rolled around and jiggled about like a sort of crazy pebble.
That's how I dance.
That's why you liked it.
You know, in that challenge, I learned to break dance, and I remember you remorselessly taking the piss out of me in the studio afterwards. But I
remember doing that
cool.
too.
Yes, indeed.
I've got another one for you, the Motorola Rocker E1, Susie, from 2005. Kind of, I guess, the first iTunes phone, not strictly iTunes, but the first MP3 phone that could apparently hold 100 songs, which at the time, I remember, would have been quite a feat, but it didn't go down well. In fact, I think it's fair to say it was an absolute disaster. And I don't know why, because there was such a buzz about MP3s back in the day.
I think, you know, it was kind of syncing up tunes, wasn't it?
It was really laborious, wasn't it?
Yeah, you had to have iTunes, and it was painfully slow at the time. I would hazard a guess that Apple killed this, actually.
Yeah.
You know, looking back, because it was 2 years before the iPhone came out, and they probably thought, hang on a minute, we need this ourselves and not to dilute it. And I reckon that's why it was, you know, kind of had such a short shelf life, really.
Well,
it could be.
The thing is, The iPod was out at that time.
Yeah.
And while it was still, you know, a relatively clunky software interface, even for the iPod initially, it was a lot smoother than most other MP3 players, and I'm guessing smoother than this phone. And I think you're probably right. They saw the writing on the wall, and they did what these big corporations do, and they made it go away. Like the MP3 Mafia.
Was it? It was kind of, you know, sold as an iPod phone. So yeah. I'm not quite sure how it got out the door, really, knowing what Apple are like. But anyway, there you go.
Yeah, but for those watching the podcast, you'll see it on screen right now. But for those listening, you can give it a googly schmoogle afterwards. But it's no iPod. It's no Johnny Ives design, this, is it? It's an ugly, functional-looking thing. Mm. So I think that was also part of it. There's no romance about its product design.
But talking of romance, the next one that I know you're going to talk about, it was a life moment for you.
Yeah, it was. It was? Yes. What Susie's referring to is the game Ride, a skateboarding game featuring none other than Tony Hawk, officially sanctioned by Tony Hawk, which came with an actual sort of virtually full-size plastic skateboard that had no wheels or trucks on it. That was meant to be the controller. So you put it on your, you know, on a rug or on the carpet, and you interacted with the game in a way that was supposed to emulate real-world skateboarding. And it did none of the sort. It did none of that. And I know this because we reviewed it on the Gadget Show, didn't we,
yep,
Suze?
In the studio.
Yeah. And I gave it a good old test at home as well, and tweeted about it. And as a skater from back in the day, I mean, I was skateboarding in the early 80s and I still skateboard today. There was no way that I was going to say that the controller experience emulated actual real world skateboarding. But I thought it was a really novel control interface and I really liked it. It brought a sense of skating, of movement into the front room in a way that I'd never experienced before. And that's what I said on X. And this is where, this is what you were referring to at the start of this little section, isn't it, Susie? Mm. I put the tweet out and guess who replied to the tweet? And they said something like, at least this guy gets it. None other than Tony Hawk. So Tony Hawk tweeted me and I couldn't believe it. I was absolutely made up, wasn't I?
It was almost as exciting as when Cindy Crawford tweeted me. They're just life moments, aren't they? That or the Fonz. I couldn't work out which one was more important to me.
Tell me more. Why did Cindy Crawford tweet you?
Oh, because she wrote a book and I bought it. I mean, I said I bought it for my ex-husband, but I actually bought it so I could read it. And I tweeted about it and she tweeted me back. So I was absolutely delighted. She was one of my faves.
I absolutely love it. So for £99.99, including this strange plastic skateboard add-on, it was meant to be a revolutionary new skateboard game, but actually everyone didn't like it. No one liked it. And now I actually still have the peripheral. In fact, I've got the Wii version of it somewhere in the loft, I think.
I'd love to go in your loft.
Oh, it's great in my loft.
Oh, my God. Beautiful. We should make a program in your loft.
Jason's loft.
Live loft sessions. Maybe we could think of a different name. But yes, just because all the stuff up there. Can you imagine? It's like a car boot sale dream, isn't it?
Jay Leno's garage. Jason Bradbury's loft. Yeah. That says it all, doesn't it?
Right.
There's no Bugattis up there, I tell you.
This is not being funny, but this has got Channel 5 written all over it.
Never again, Susan.
Do you remember them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's move on. What about the Seiko TV watch from 1982? Now, this was the world's very first TV watch, as you well know.
I'm excited already. Carry on.
Well, long before the Apple Watch, Seiko made a watch that you could play live TV on. The only problem was that you had to carry the whole receiver pack, which was the size of a Walkman, to actually use it. So it came out, as I said, in 1982. It was in the early 80s. The screen was 1.2 inch. It was black and white LCD. Amazing. And like I said, you had to have this, you know, separate receiver pack, which was also connected by a cable, obviously, back then. The battery life was only a couple of hours, didn't last very long. And the price at launch was £380, which was a lot of money in 1982.
You'd be better off with the Sinclair TV, wouldn't you? You know, Sir Clive Sinclair made a portable.
Are you on the Sir Clive Sinclair thing again?
Of course I am. Which is a much better idea. I mean, even now, it's, you know, watching TV on a wristwatch isn't like a normal thing, is it? It's still quite a technical achievement, actually. So Yeah. Back then, I mean, wow, to even get a picture on something in 1982? My God, that's amazing. Yeah. Well done,
it
Seiko.
It is amazing. Absolutely. I mean, it, like a lot of these weird and wonderful retro gadgets, that they are massively ahead of their time. But, you know, because of that, the idea was ahead of the technology that was available, effectively, which is why a lot of the things that we're saying, too big, too clunky, too expensive, and all of those things really for this one. I'm going to talk about the Casio Loopy, Jace, which was a games console which was specifically aimed at girls. It had a built-in sticker printer.
Love it. Love it already.
It was aimed at teenage girls, really, in Japan. But nobody really bought it. It was released in 1995, only in Japan, actually. They only released 10 games as well. So it had this, like I said, it had this built-in thermal printer for making stickers, which that's just after I left Japan, actually. And in those days in Japan, you know, there were stickers everywhere. And there still is in Japan, you know. It is very much in the culture, you know, particularly with teenage girls. They love that whole sticker vibe thing. So I'm a bit surprised it didn't work, actually, back in the 90s. I would have thought that, you know, they would have gone for that, but they didn't anyway. It was kind of cool, but very, very niche, I suppose. And that's for that reason, the Casio Loopy
kind of
looped out.
You've opened my eyes to a gadget I'd never even heard of. I'm fascinated by that.
Maybe gadget too far, you know. Maybe it was just that combination of things that didn't quite work together.
That's what we should call this section of the podcast.
A gadget too far.
I like it. Well, in the gadget too far category, I'm going to put the...
You just changed it mid-pod, but I'm all over it. Okay.
Yeah, thank you. The Nabaz Tag. Now, I don't know if I'm saying that right. I'm almost certainly butchering it, but it came from 2005. And how would I describe it? The internet rabbit, all right? So imagine if Alexa... Say again?
Careful.
Okay, so imagine if Alexa was a cute plastic rabbit and, you know, completely useless. It was kind of a voice assistant, so it could read weather, RSS feeds, which, if you remember, back in the day were all the rage. And it could read your emails aloud. And at launch, it was about £80. All right.
Yeah.
Why was it strange, Susie? Because the idea of a smart assistant was cool. But as you know, with recent developments in AI, it's only in the last couple of years that virtual assistants have become actually meaningful and intelligent in a way that's relatable. So back then, it was way too limited in its ability to construct any useful output to be, you know, to be popular.
So to be clear, it was a talking rabbit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why I didn't catch on. What about Dreamcast Fishing Controller?
Oh, come
back
on.
In 1999.
Why is that in this category? Carry on.
Come on. Oh, should we have a fight about this one?
Go on then.
Well, imagine playing a fishing game with an actual rod controller, complete with a reel. And Sega thought that this was going to be the next big thing. And it actually did work. So it was released in 1999. Do you remember it?
I do. I used to play Sega Bass on my Dreamcast.
Oh, okay, yes.
I was just looking at a picture of it on the internet.
So the compatible games for it, as Jace mentioned there, Sega Bass Fishing, Marine Fishing, and even Soul Calibur. Yes, I know. The controls had this sort of reel function, motion-based casting, and vibration feedback as well. So it's like sort of 3D, effectively. Was that 4D? That's 4D, isn't it? Why was it weird? Well, you know. A fishing rod.
I guess fishing is weird for some people.
Yeah, but a fishing rod as a kind of fighting game control is
But you could use it in Soul Calibur to wield your sword and stuff. But
your fishing rod.
Yeah, and you could literally move it around like a Wii controller on a Sega Dreamcast. But that's not what it was designed for. Playing Sega Bass on that controller, some of the best gaming experiences I can remember. I mean,
really?
I thought, yes, because it was so stupid. Remember, we're talking about the gaming company that brought us those sorts of odd arcade experiences. I don't know necessarily that these are Sega, but things like, you know, that one in the Tokyo arcades where you upturn the table, you know, that's a game interface.
Right.
And other kinds of weird ways of interacting with, you know, digital assets on screen. it's got a long tradition in gaming, and I think that the fishing controller was one of those weird, quirky, fun experiences where if you had friends round, that's the one they'd want to play. Think about it. Do you want to play on the controllers yet another fighting game, or do you want to cast the rod and get some fish and then use the same thing on the fighting game? It's brilliant. It's so novel, so creative. And it, from memory, not that I'm a fisherman, but it actually worked.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, that it worked?
Yeah.
Because you think, like, I mean, the fishing, my brother fishes, and the fishing sort of fraternity, they're quite, they always say, like, it's the biggest sport in the UK. I'm like, it's not a sport, is it, fishing? And then they go, it's the most dangerous, more people die fishing every year. I'm like, they can't do. No, I'm sure they sit there while they're fishing.
It's the most dangerous.
Well, yeah. Motorbike racing probably isn't great either. But
I think basically we all say our sport, don't we? I'm going to say skateboarding is the most dangerous sport.
Why
in
would
the
you
world.
Want to advertise it? But I think they sit there fishing for so long, they just come up with things.
They just fall in.
Just like.
It's so boring. They fall asleep and fall in.
No,
joke.
I mean, have a go at us, because neither of us fish. We don't get it. We don't understand it. But I've always been just mildly interested in, you know, why. But also, I don't like the idea of hooking a fish. But that's another podcast.
If you're going to eat it, you've got to be prepared to hook it. Look, I live in Cornwall, as you know, and I... Only you could find that smutty. And I often go...
I didn't find it smutty. I was just thinking, there's a nice catch line for Findus right there.
If you can't... No, what was it? If you're going to eat it,
you've got to hook it.
Look, I live near a harbour. It's literally a few hundred metres down over there. Right, I'm pointing, by the way, for those of you listening. And I often see the fishermen, the fisher people, and I'd love to join them. In fact, I'd like to go out on a boat and learn to fish. But look, so far, the nearest I'll ever get to it is that brilliant controller in Sega Bass.
Oh, you love that controller. I feel a victory coming on for that controller. We've got one more, though.
Go on, then.
Moving on from, if you're going to eat it, you've got to hook it. The Game Boy Camera and Printer,
wow,
1998, was one of the weirdest.
Yeah, travesty of justice.
Yeah, but it's brilliant.
Yes.
It's one of the most weirdest and brilliant gadgets of the late 90s, isn't it? And,
yeah.
And you know, this is the reason why, really. It's like it's a chunky, rotating, black and white digital camera that plugged into the Game Boy.
Yeah.
It was weird because the camera had, like, a creepy built-in filter. So, you know, distorted faces, nightmare kind of inducing animations. It made it feel like it was sort of accidentally horrifying, didn't it?
Well, and also lots of games and things like that. And
yeah, lots of cool features.
Visual effects, yeah.
So you could take sort of low-res selfies and you could create pixel art. Technically, it was the world's smallest digital camera, actually, at the time.
It was the world's first selfie camera, wasn't it? Because you could move the camera around. And actually, sorry, I know you're in your flow, but now they're highly prized, these things, Suze. If you went on to eBay, I would imagine they'd fetch a pretty penny.
Yeah. You know, people still use it for retro photography. Do you want to do the Game Boy printer?
Well, yeah, because the printer was the peripheral that came with the camera. It didn't come with it, but you could buy it and utilise it with it. And the quality's great. I mean, you mentioned low res. This is low, low, low res. I don't know enough about it. I think it was probably one of these thermal ones again that you mentioned earlier, was it? I don't know.
Yeah.
Recently, people with the Game Boy camera printers were unable to use them because I seem to remember the manufacturer of the paper, the right size, the roll of paper that you needed to do it, actually went out of business or stopped producing it. But that's not the case anymore. Someone else is doing it now. And you
can
print these out. Yeah, I tell you something. There was a homebrew project that I came across a year or so ago. And I seem to remember what someone had done is they'd messed around with the electronics and they'd done some wizardry with the circuitry. And they'd made it so they could stream on the Game Boy camera like a webcam. And they were doing like streaming shows on Twitch. but everyone's tuning in just to see how bad the camera looked. I think it's cool. It's got that artisan thing.
Yeah. I used to use the photos, the prints, they faded quickly over time because they used that sticker paper so you could, you know, stick the pictures on your school books or your fridge or, you know, wherever you wanted to put your stickers. I feel like I've been obsessed with stickers today. I suppose the legacy of it really was that it was a precursor to portable photo printers like Instax and Polaroid Inc.
Yes, and the camera, of course, the first selfie camera, really?
Yeah. It turned a gaming console into a digital camera before phones did, didn't it, really?
There you go.
That was its sort of USP. I mean, the print quality was absolute crap. But it sort of added to the faded charm.
But it gets a gold star from us.
Yeah. So there you go. That's what we've come up with. And I think if we're both going to pick the weirdest one, I'm going to go with Satellaview.
Okay, so yeah, weirdest, but also for me, my absolute fave from that list, it's got to be the fishing controller for the Dreamcast, Suze. Absolutely loved it.
Okay.
Can we have an honorary mention?
Of Tony Hawk?
Yes.
The
Tony
Crawford.
Hawk skateboard ride controller.
Okay.
But thanks, Tony.
It doesn't matter what we think. We want to know what you think. So which of those gadgets? We're not talking about the worst. We're talking about the freaky-deakiest, the weirdest. What is the weirdest gadget? Note in the comments and let us know what you think and why. And if you have any experience, we would love to hear your stories.
And we'll try and pick up on that, won't we, your comments in future episodes.
Good idea.
Good stuff.
For our gadget of interest this week, it's the Pebble smartwatch.
Oh, I like it. So, you know, we're still continuing the retro theme somewhat, Suze.
Well, yes, as you know, Jace, the Pebble was a pioneer in the smartwatch industry, known for its e-paper display and impressive battery life way back in 2013. But now, Eric Migikowski, the founder of Pebble, is making a comeback.
Amazing.
After Google's acquisition of Fitbit, which had previously acquired Pebble, of course, they decided to open source the Pebble OS. Now, Eric is seizing this opportunity to revive the Pebble experience.
That's absolutely, it's awesome. I love this story. Tell me more.
I knew you would like this. So he's establishing a new company to produce wearables that capture the essence of the original Pebble. So think e-paper screens.
Love it.
Long battery life and a user-friendly experience. He's already working on hardware prototypes and aims to build, as he's calling it, a spiritual clone of the original Pebble. I know it's there's a bit marketing in that, isn't it? The spiritual clone. But, you know, stay with me on it.
But Eric is clearly, you know, channeling the importance of the community, because you remember this, Suze, because we were right on the Pebble, weren't we, when it was first Kickstarter funded. I think it was the biggest Kickstarter fund ever, certainly back then. 10 million or something. And the community around that phone, that smartwatch, it was something to behold, wasn't it? People didn't just like it, they loved it. And they all got on each time a new app was released and they would chat in the forums about it. And, you know, nowadays you can't buy that kind of loyalty, can you? And that's what I think he's probably trying to tap into.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to see the, you know, the fundamentals that made Pebble stand out.
But it's also going to obviously make use of some more modern functionality, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a saturated market, really, with, you know, feature-heavy smartwatches, a focus on simplicity, if you like, and longevity. It could be a game-changer, couldn't it?
Yeah, do you think maybe some kind of biometrics as well? Because I understand, I'm not missing the point, the great thing about the original Pebble and
the simplicity.
Display. Yes, and the fact that it didn't have a big draw on the battery, right?
Yeah.
But because of the exponential nature of all of these, you know, electronic pieces of wizardry, they can now be made. Things like simple monitors for your, I don't know, your heart rate, for example, that draw less electricity than maybe they did when they were first released. So it'd be interesting to see if Eric can, you know, put some more advanced features into this latest variation of a Pebble-like watch.
Well, they have been busy because, you know, talking of new release there, the Pebble under Google have been, you know, working. And in August last year, 2024, they launched the Ultralife, which is a stylish smartwatch boasting a 12-day battery life on a single charge. That's extraordinary, isn't it? And it features a 1.83-inch true HD display with 600 nits brightness, which ensures that visibility, even in bright sunlight, I'm told, is good. It's also IP68 certified, making it dust, sweat and indeed splash proof.
And so that's different to the Pebble Royale, isn't it? Which I think was earlier in March 2024.
Yeah, the Royale is touted as the world's slimmest Bluetooth calling smartwatch.
There you go, yeah.
With a sleek, it's got a 6mm thick circular stainless steel dial, and it boasts a 1.43-inch Super AMOLED display, which supports advanced Bluetooth calling, allowing users to make and receive calls using voice commands through the built-in voice assistant.
So whether it's the originator's new, yet-to-be-showcased venture, or, of course, Google's exploits, it's great to see, you know, Pebble or the Pebble concept being innovated while still staying true to the core values of one of the most enthusiastic tech communities I've ever come across.
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll keep our eye on Pebble's developments and share any updates as they come in. Like you say, you know, we do have a vested interest, really, in just because we loved it back in the day, really. Yeah. So stay tuned for more on the Gadget Show podcast.
Love it. Thanks, Suze. What can I say? That's a wrap for this week's podcast. But before we go, here's a quick reminder about that exclusive NordVPN deal. Head to nordvpn.com/gadgetshow and you'll get 4 extra months free on a 2-year plan.
Yeah, it's a perfect way to lock down your data, browse safely and access the internet without any restrictions.
Whether you're streaming, shopping or just browsing, NordVPN keeps you safe every step of the way.
Yeah, so that's nordvpn.com/gadgetshow or just tap the link in the episode description. So stay secure, stay connected, and we'll catch you next time. But don't forget, if you're going to eat it, you've got to hook it.
I couldn't have said it better myself. See you next time.
Bye. The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Susie was presented by Jason Bradbury and Susie Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.